Welcome back to another episode of Spotlight on AML, brought to you by Jade Third Eye. My name is Adrian Isaac, a client manager with Jade. Thank you for joining us, and I hope you're sitting comfortably. I'm very excited about today's episode, as I'm joined by a senior member of the City of London Police, at the forefront of fighting fraud across the UK. Today, my guest is Gareth Doty. Gareth is the Detective Inspector Fraud Operations, National Lead Force, Economic Crime Directorate. Thank you for joining me today, Gareth. How are you?
Oh, thanks very much for inviting me, Adrian. I'm very well. Thank you.
It was very hard for me to condense the vast amount of questions that I wanted to cover with you today. So without further delay, let's get into it. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about the role of City of London Police in fighting financial crime and fraud?
Yeah, absolutely. So the City of London Police is the national lead force for fraud in the UK. And what that effectively means is that we have a role in coordinating sort of counter fraud activity to all of the police forces across the UK, with the home of the National Fraud Intelligence Bureau and Action Fraud. So it's the one way in to reporting fraud, and it's the intelligence bureau that deals with all fraud reports, does the analysis, works out those cases that are to, you know, most likely to get good outcomes, and then disseminates them across the UK. We're also the link in with other areas of law enforcement via the National Economic Crime Centre, the NEC, which is part of the NCA. And we also work with other agencies like Trading Standards, HMRC and so forth. Because we're the sort of the lead force, we've got a number of different investigation teams here focusing on different areas of fraud, some of which are sort of partnership type departments working with private industry or with the Metropolitan Police, or others like my own, which is fraud operations, which is a bit more of a standalone, but we focus on sort of nationally significant frauds and high harm fraud types, such as investment fraud, romance fraud, and courier fraud. Normally, those sort of frauds are perpetrated by organised crime groups and have a national footprint, or even to a certain extent, sort of international footprints as well. We work in terms of sort of the coordination side. We work towards developing training, investigation guidance and toolkits, which are shared nationally. And I know certainly when we were chatting before, Adrian, we were talking about sort of rolling technology and how important it is. And that's something that we've been looking at here as well. Clearly, you know, the amount of fraud is huge, and the amount of material involved in fraud investigation is huge as well. So we're sort of exploring, you know, artificial intelligence and other programs and things to help us better combat fraud and be ready for, you know, sort of fraud threats sort of coming in the future. And that's something that we do, obviously, for our own investigation teams, and obviously providing sort of guidance to other forces as well.
What are you doing in terms of educating people around the new challenges that we're facing with financial crime and fraud, particularly around technology?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I think educating the public as, you know, as consumers and as potential victims, and also educating companies is really important. I think probably the more informed everyone is, the more likely they are to identify those sort of scams and frauds and be able to protect themselves. And we do quite a lot of work with both ourselves in terms of fraud campaigns around specific things such as romance fraud. We also work with UK Finance, the Take Five to Stop Fraud, Stop Scams campaign, and other organisations as well, to make sure that up-to-date information is being released to the public, particularly, you know, around sort of Christmas time or other times of year where there is, you know, an increase in fraud, to make sure that people are are as educated as they can be to try and stop themselves from, you know, clicking on those links or making sure they put the phone down to cold calls or whatever else it happens to be. In terms of sort of the technology side of things, I mean, I think the big threat continues to be cyber type attacks that are the start of fraud. I think it's something like 80% of fraud starts as a cyber cyber attack, whether it be, you know, phishing or whatever else. So awareness of the use of technology, and in terms of companies as well, the use of technology themselves in order to you know, sort of spot attacks, whether it be to fraud or sort of insider threats, is really important as well.
I believe that within that 80% statistic, the vast majority of fraud is actually taking place within maybe one or two of the major players within the social media space, particularly without naming names. How are you finding the cooperation between yourselves and those organisations in the fight against fraud?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think obviously in recent years there's been a huge increase in how important social media is to people and how much people rely on it for information, education, advice and all these sorts of things. And obviously some of these platforms aren't as well regulated as traditional media, and potentially there's a gap there that fraudsters can exploit. So I think it's hugely impactful in the way that fraudsters try to commit fraud. But it also means that, you know, we need to be aware as consumers of the dangers of using these sorts of platforms. Now, in terms of the engagement, I think that's patchy, to probably put it politely. We always encourage as much engagement and collaboration as possible with all of these different organisations. The more that they can get involved and we can get involved, we can share information and be proactive about taking down adverts that are a threat or social media accounts that are fraudulent or whatever else, then the more likely we are to get ahead of the fraud and stop it from happening. Because, you know, investigating frauds after they've happened is, you know, it's a good thing. But actually we want people to not be scammed in the first place.
So moving on, Gareth, are there any specific patterns or types of financial crime that you are seeing?
Yeah, fraud continues to be a really significant threat across all crime types. It represents something like 40% or over 40% of all recorded crime. And of course, it's one of those crime types that we think is probably quite significantly underreported as well. In terms of sort of the breakdown of different types of fraud, sort of debit card and credit card fraud is the highest by quite a margin. In terms of purchase scams, as I mentioned before, the use of social media and marketplace platforms to sell goods, fraudulently has increased a lot in recent times. For example, selling cars. I think any of your listeners that are, you know, in the financial sector will know that authorised fraud and authorised push payment fraud is a huge issue. I think 2021 to 22, we saw a 10% move away from unauthorised fraud towards authorised fraud types, and that includes things like investment fraud and romance fraud, the sorts of things that require the criminals to manipulate and groom their victims into agreeing to transfer cash. So I think all of those are probably still very much hot topics at the moment.
What sort of things can our listeners working in financial crime teams be on the lookout for to help in the fight and protect their customers?
Yeah, so in terms of investment fraud, for example, we've seen more of a focus towards new technology investments. I say investments, or, you know, purported investments, such as in cryptocurrencies. And again, mentioned a couple of times, but use of social media in advertising and in chat groups to try and sort of drum up interest. Even if we see these investment fraud companies are UK based, we also still see the laundering of funds internationally. And in the largest of these organisations, we see a level of professionality in the laundering as well. So the fraudsters who are getting the money from cold calling or adverts on search engines, for example, are then paying professional launderers to move the funds internationally, you know, via whatever layering methods that they use, and then to put the money back into accounts that they can be used to pay for, you know, pay the fraudsters a salary, if you like. In terms of romance fraud, which is an area that I lead on here in Fraud Ops, this is very much the authorized kind of fraud type. So there's often a long-term manipulation and grooming of the victims. And the kind of consequence from a sort of a company side is that they often get trained and told how to get around checks, how to, you know, told what to say if the bank calls them, or they get told to put payments through as gifts as opposed to, say, investment in investment fraud, to try and get around some of these sorts of checks. And we often see, again, with the romance fraud, that they're perpetrated by organised crime groups. So we see UK victims getting targeted from overseas. And because of that, you see the money moving between countries as well as part of that laundering. And we also see the use of other victims as mules. So the victim will get convinced to allow their account to be used to move funds to try and that the forces use that to try and hide behind. So those are sort of some of the you know, sort of the things that we see in terms of the frauds.
Just highlighting how intrinsically linked fraud and money laundering really are.
Absolutely. I mean, we're you know, this department is called Fraud Operations, but actually all of our investigations are fraud and money laundering investigations, because fundamentally any fraudster has to, you know, move or use the funds. And particularly if we're talking about a large organised crime group, then, you know, there's a level of sophistication there, a level of professionality, and it takes, you know, it takes time and it takes expertise to sort of uncover and to follow that money and hopefully to get some of it back to victims as well.
Is there any insights you can offer around detecting these criminal accounts of the criminal activity, any, you know, patterns of transactions, account behaviours that could indicate a suspicious account?
Yeah, I mean, I think the sorts of red flags that we see in fraud are very similar to the things you'd see in money laundering. You know, say for an investment fraud, you might see money coming into company accounts, then very quickly being moved out. So at the end of the day, you might have an empty account, or money being moved very rapidly between different accounts and then moved out of the company. We also see movement of money between different companies that are owned by or controlled by the same directors, money going back and forth, and employees being or getting, you know, salaries or bonuses from accounts that are associated, or companies that are associated but they don't actually work for, the sorts of things you're unlikely to see in a legitimate company.
Going back to the investment fraud topic, am I right in saying that it's prevalent amongst, or the victims of this are actually generally young men, particularly around crypto? Is that what you're seeing out there? I'm just thinking in terms of, you know, patterns and types of people, you know, activity people are looking out for. Would that be a correct statement?
Yeah, certainly in terms of the crypto, that's right. I mean, I think traditionally when we think about investment fraud, and the sort of the demographic targets of fraudsters. They're quite often looking for people with, you know, maybe a bit older, maybe with savings or a pension to invest. And that's still very much the case. But what we have seen, as you've said, is that we've seen more of a move towards the focus on targeting younger people, particularly men, people who would be interested in, say, cryptocurrencies and new technologies, and maybe less of an interest in investment and finance and things. So we find people that have a different set of interests, and they're being targeted specifically for those cryptocurrency scams, and they might be targeted in a different way. So if you were looking to scam someone who had a bit more money, you might think that they have funds to spare and they might have some experience investing. But with the younger demographic, quite often what the fraudsters are doing, they're using chat platforms and online forums to talk about the investments that they have had and the money that they have made in order to get some interest in them, and then sort of try and then lead them onto these investment companies. So it's a slightly different approach, but definitely we've seen a trend towards that younger demographic for those investment fraud types.
Right. Okay, so moving on now to slight change of topic. What does City of London Police look for from private sector collaboration?
Yeah, the City of London Police, we've got quite a few different collaboration projects going on, and we've got a number of different departments here which are set up jointly working with the private sector. For example, the dedicated card and payment unit, which works with UK Finance as well as the Metropolitan Police. They get a lot of their referrals from the banking sector, from the members of UK Finance. We also have insurance fraud enforcement, which, as you'd imagine, is around insurance. We also have a department is dedicated towards intellectual property crime as well. And of course, we have oversight from the Home Office to ensure, you know, transparency and objectivity and so forth. So we've got some really successful projects around the sort of reactive and the criminal investigation. But through those as well, we do a lot of information and education pieces, sort of sharing up to date threats and trends and trying to educate people about how to protect themselves.
What should the private sector companies be doing to help? You got any examples of any partnerships working successfully at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think all industries have a joint responsibility to combat fraud. You know, law enforcement, banks, professional services, individual companies, everyone really. And I think part of that is professional curiosity and just being aware of potential threats that might be within the given industry, making sure that companies are educating their staff not only how to, you know, look after the company themselves, but also customers. And around that, I'm thinking, you know, being aware of cybercrime scams and phishing, or payment diversion scams, CEO type frauds that would affect the company, but also the sorts of communication that would be useful for their customers to protect themselves. And I really think that, you know, making sure that the companies have clear lines of communication, they're bringing updates clearly and in a timely way to make sure that their customers are educated is really helpful. And of course, the other side of it is if members of staff spot any issues or concerns, then report them. Obviously, you know, if we're talking about sectors that are, you know, regulated, they're going to have a framework in place. You know, they might be able to report SARS. But even if not, then Action Fraud is for anyone, any company to report frauds or intelligence and so forth. And that's something that we can then have a look at and sort of see if there's any trends and patterns. So I think there's a combination of things there. It's companies and individuals being able to look after themselves and being aware, and also communication with customers to make sure that information is circulating. And again, making sure if those threats get back to policing or the NCA in order to take any action.
You mentioned SARS, and rather nicely timed, you mentioned the NCA. So SARS play a big role in supporting investigations. How can the industry make sure they're submitting what really helps in a SAR?
Yeah, SARs are really important. It's really important that all companies, regulated firms, professional services, have that vigilance and have the processes in place to proactively look at what's going on with their, their business, with their customers, with their partners, and they're able to report it, in a timely way. Many companies are very good at this. Some clearly are not. We get investigations where, it looks like there's ready information available within companies and nothing's done with it. And that's obviously concerning. And in terms of SARS, it probably seems like they go into a bit of a black hole, but they really are extremely useful. I mean, every year we freeze something like £300 million worth of criminal assets just off the back of SAR reports. And of course, that's sort of the step one, if you like. The beauty of those reports is that it means that we, as law enforcement, can get information about criminal activity much quicker than if we waited for, the scam to reach its sort of end point and the victims become aware of it and then report. That means we can take action much quicker. We can seize evidence. We can hopefully freeze further assets. We can make arrests, and hopefully we can get some of those funds back to victims and to prevent some of these organised crime groups from, making more victims, if you like. In terms of what's useful, in terms of writing the SAR, the context is really important. A one-liner saying that someone was suspicious, it isn't necessarily that helpful. If you imagine, all of the organisations that are putting SAR reports in every single day, it can be quite hard to work out what's the most relevant, what's the biggest threat if you haven't got that detail. So adding the context, why was whatever behaviour suspicious? Is there anything that's led up to it? And also, if an organisation knows the force that's dealing with a case, so for example, you get SARs come back after we've submitted production orders to get information. If the organisation knows, say, the City of London Police are investigating, or not even know the officer involved or the operation name, put that on the SAR. It makes it much more straightforward for the NCA to do that assessment and get the SAR to the right person so that they can join up that intelligence. And the other thing to consider is that I was just thinking about SARS being a bit of a going into a black hole, is that we do consider it to be intelligence, and the people, the organizations that submit them to be sources of intelligence. So that's why you don't hear back about these things. It's one of the kind of the strictest rule sets that we have, if you like, is protecting sources of intelligence. We never, we don't reveal the contents of SARs. We don't reveal where they came from, even if a case gets to court. We have to find parallels for that intelligence in terms of evidence, and it will never come to light. So it might be frustrating that a SAR doesn't get any feedback, but they're really, really helpful. And there is good reason for not getting that feedback as well. And I guess one of the other things to say is that even if law enforcement, whether it be policing or the FCA or NCA or whoever else, doesn't necessarily act on a SAR immediately, it still goes into a database of intelligence that can be analysed an assessment on an ongoing basis. And it might be that if I've got an investigation, I can then have one of my team do research, and we could then find SARS from a number of different sources. And when joined up together, produces a really rich intelligence picture, which can inform our investigations. So sometimes it's not necessarily an individual trigger for action, but it contributes to a bigger picture that can help us understand the workings of the organized crime group, or the way the scam is perpetrated, or the network of people laundering, or whatever else it has to be. So, you know, it really does form part of a wider network of information and investigation.
I think that's an absolutely fantastic insight there, because I think there's a lot of people who are under the impression that it does perhaps go into a black hole. So to know how it's being utilized and the context of that from your side of things will give people greater confidence that they are contributing to the cause. And whilst they might not get, like you say, feedback or recognition on it, it is actually helping. And every piece of information is important. So people should continue to feel engaged in that process, because it actually is working.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's absolutely critical that we have this information. As I said before, it can quite often be, it can really shortcut an investigation and allow us to take action much quicker. And if you think about an investment fraud, for example, quite often they're set up for the investment could be, you know, 5 years or something like this. So it might be 5 years before the victim realised that the money is gone, by which point it's been moved, it's been spent, it's gone abroad, it's been hidden. Whereas a bank or whoever else who says, actually, this is a bit fishy, there's something funny going in there. When that money gets moved inside the company or from the victim or whatever else, we could take action, you know, 4.5 years earlier. And that can make a huge difference to us in terms of gathering evidence, catching suspects in the act, and also freezing those assets so we can get them back to victims.
I think that would be a good place to wrap things up. Gareth, thank you very much for your time today. I'm sure the listener will have learned a lot.
No, thank you very much for the opportunity.
It's my pleasure. This podcast was presented to you by Jade Third Eye, a Skipton Group company specialising in transaction monitoring, watchlist screening and case management. To find out more, please visit jadethirdeye.com.